Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 22nd, 2022 issue of The Week. We have our first new issue of the week in several weeks, and of course a lot's been going on in the world, perhaps most notably the death of Queen Elizabeth. The cover drawing this week shows former Prince Charles of England, now King Charles. He's got his typically sort of somber look on his face, and holding out in front of him the royal crown. On a table beside him is a framed picture of his mother, Queen Elizabeth. And the headline is, "Enter the King. Can Charles III live up to Queen Elizabeth's legacy?" That is our first main story, and we'll start there. Charles III takes throne as UK mourns Elizabeth II. What happened? King Charles III assumed the mantle as Britain's new monarch this week, vowing to uphold his mother's legacy of selfless service as a stunned nation mourned the passing of Queen Elizabeth II after 70 years on the throne. After the Queen's death at 96 was announced, throngs of Britons gathered to pay tribute to the only monarch most had ever known, one who'd ascended to the throne at 25 and ruled through 15 prime ministers and 14 U.S. presidents. "It's a massive shock to the nation," said Adam Wilkinson Hill, 22, one of thousands who massed in front of Buckingham Palace, crying, hugging, and piling bouquets in stacks. The head of state for more than a dozen countries from Jamaica to New Zealand, Elizabeth died 2 days after appointing a new prime minister, Liz Truss, to replace the resigning Boris Johnson. "She was the rock on which modern Britain was built," said Truss. Charles, 73, was proclaimed the new monarch at a ceremony marked by gun salutes and trumpet blast. The oldest person ever to ascend to the British throne, the former Prince of Wales comes to the job after a lifetime of training, but still does not benefit from the deep admiration from the public that his mother enjoyed. He paid tribute to her duration, dedication, and devotion, and pledged to follow the inspiring example I have been set. He began a tour of the UK's four nations with a visit to Northern Ireland and recorded televised address to the British people. "I shall endeavor to serve you with loyalty, respect, and love, as I have throughout my life," he said. The Queen's body was taken from Balmoral Castle, the summer residence in Scotland where she died, to Edinburgh, then to Buckingham Palace. On Wednesday, her coffin was brought by horse-drawn carriage to Westminster Hall to lie in state for 4 days, where the line of visiting mourners was expected to stretch for miles. "I have known her all my life, and now she's gone," said retired butcher Dave Stanley, 78. "It's the end of an era." What the editorial said: "We've lost a world leader whose decades of selfless duty inspired untold millions," said the Houston Chronicle. "A wise woman who personified strength at a time when few got the chance, Elizabeth was a grand figure in a fast food world starved for grandeur, who gave her nation a beacon of stability through times of tumult. Even Americans who prefer elections to royal bloodlines and rigid class hierarchies should mourn the loss of her duty, grace, and restraint." "Elizabeth's death is a national shock," said The Guardian. "Born when Britain ruled a vast global empire, she was a steady presence amid decades of epochal changes. She leaves behind a nation with an uncertain future and growing questions about the monarchy's role in it. These are sure to grow under Charles, who lacks his mother's star power, popularity, and public restraint. Thus begins a new and unwritten chapter for the British monarchy and the country itself. What the columnist said. "Go ahead and mourn the Queen," said Karen Atiyah in the Washington Post. "But we must speak the ugly truths about the racist colonial empire she so dutifully represented. Amid the hagiographies, fantasy and ignorance are colliding with Britain's brutal record of subjugation and the lingering bitterness of those whose families suffered massacre and displacement as the Queen draped herself in plundered jewels. With a mother who grew up singing God Save the Queen in pre-independence Nigeria, it's a legacy I can't forgive." "Elizabeth leaves a gaping void," said Jeffrey Wheatcroft in New York Magazine, "and we Brits aren't quite sure about the man who now steps into it. Not all the derision heaped on Charles ever since the death of Princess Diana 25 years ago has been fair, but he's a crank who has damaged his image with his all-too-public marital difficulties and ignored a key reason for his mother's success. She kept her opinions to herself. Instead, he's lobbied cabinet members and aired his views on everything from climate to alternative medicine, coming off as the sort of chap you shy away from in the pub." "Where does the British monarchy go now?" said John Cassidy in the New Yorker. "Even as a higher hereditary monarch atop a democratic state increasingly seems like an anachronism, the royal family remains resoundingly popular. The looming question is whether Charles can maintain such support, not only at home but also in the 14 former colonies where he'll serve as head of state. On both fronts, supporters of the monarchy have reason to be concerned. In this day and age, a constitutional monarchy is logically indefensible," said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter, "but it's nonetheless a legacy worth holding on to. The crown is a unifying force that transcends contemporary political divisions and offers a symbol of continuity and stability that bestows meaning and happiness. In times of profound acrimony, that's a gift whose value is hard to measure. The queen is dead. Long live the king." And we have a second main story today. Ukrainian troops send Russians fleeing in the northeast. What happened? In a dramatic reshaping of the battlefield, Ukrainian forces chased Russian troops out of much of Kharkiv over the past 2 weeks, retaking in days what it took Russia months to capture. Ukraine tricked Russia by telegraphing its plans for a major counteroffensive in the south around Kherson, causing Russian commanders to shift tens of thousands of troops to that region. Ukraine did make modest gains in the south, but the bulk of its forces burst through Russian front lines in the northeast over the past 2 weeks, winning back 3,000 square miles of territory, more than a tenth of Russia's total gain since the February 24th invasion. Among the dozens of settlements they liberated were Izium, Kapiansk, and Balakhila, key logistical hubs for Russian forces. The attack severely degraded the Russian forces that had remained in the north, including at least one ostensibly elite unit, and sent them into headlong retreat. Russian soldiers abandoned their equipment, including about 40 tanks, 35 military vehicles, and even two jets, and some attempted to disguise themselves as civilians. Russia called the retreat a strategic regrouping and responded with widespread shelling, damaging power stations in Kharkiv and other cities. But cracks in Russia's pro-war consensus appeared to be growing. Pundits on state television, which usually follows the Kremlin line, said the war might not be winnable or even worthwhile, while low-level city officials in Moscow and St. Petersburg called on President Vladimir Putin to resign. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made a surprise visit to Izium to mark his country's recent victories. "Our blue and yellow flag is already flying in deoccupied Izium," he said, It will be so in every Ukrainian city and village. What the editorial said. The Ukrainians have pulled off the seemingly impossible, said the Boston Globe. The trap they set for the Russians in the south allowed them to barrel ahead in the north, erasing Russian gains since April. The morale of the Russians, fighting with old equipment and for a cause many have long since lost faith in, is plummeting. Russian desertions are becoming so common that Ukraine has set up a surrender hotline for soldiers to call. Incredibly, a path to Ukrainian victory seems to be opening. Yet this jubilant moment is not without peril, said the Wall Street Journal. Ukraine's battlefield coups are a major humiliation for Putin, who could now be capable of anything. Will he call a draft, risking unrest at home? Will he engage NATO forces in some fashion? Might he even reach for tactical nukes? That last idea is horrific to contemplate, but Western leaders need to plan for such a horror now rather than thinking it can't happen. What the columnist said. The Southern Front wasn't a mere distraction, said Dalibor Rohak in the New York Post. Ukrainian troops there have been grinding away at Russian capabilities, and though their enemy still has a bigger arsenal, the Ukrainians now enjoy the technological edge, having transitioned from their Cold War-era arms to modern weaponry supplied by NATO countries. Russia, by contrast, is increasingly relying on faulty drones from Iran and artillery shells from North Korea. But Ukraine's window for success may soon close, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. The muddy season that bogged down Russian tanks in March will be back this fall, and it generally favors defense over offense. By winter, the ice may largely freeze the front lines in place. President Biden, who deserves full credit for robustly arming Ukraine so far, should recognize that further advances demand air power and give Kyiv our nearly four dozen aging F-16s. Even if they prove ephemeral, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic, Ukraine's recent gains change the nature of this war. An outright victory and a potentially fatal crisis of legitimacy for Putin could follow. This is not a prediction. It's a warning. Russia has no mechanism for replacing its tyrannical president, and there's no telling what will happen if political elites turn on him. Western leaders mustn't meddle in Russian politics, of course, as that would backfire, but they needn't lend Putin legitimacy he doesn't deserve in future negotiations. The possibility of instability in Russia, a nuclear power, terrifies many, but it may now be unavoidable. Controversy of the week is Mar-a-Lago investigation. Is it stalling out? Since the FBI showed up at Mar-a-Lago searching for sensitive government documents in early August, Donald Trump has tried to hurl one monkey wrench after another into the investigation, said Carol Lamb in NBC News. His legal team has produced a blizzard of filings in an attempt to stall the Justice Department's probe into why the former president took the documents to his Florida home when he left the White House, why he refused to give them back despite repeated official requests, and what he did with them in the intervening year and a half. Now those desperate efforts may be gaining traction. Last week, despite reports that the classified documents included details of a foreign country's nuclear program, Judge Aileen Cannon granted Trump's absurd request for a special master to review the seized documents. That could set up a protracted court fight over whom to name in that role, said Alan Foyer and Charlie Savage in the New York Times. This week, the Department of Justice agreed to one of Trump's suggestions, retired Judge Raymond Deary. But even if Deary is appointed, the 78-year-old will still have to wade through some 13,000 documents to see whether any are personal or protected by executive privilege, a complex region of constitutional law that could tie up the case in litigation for months. Trump has succeeded for now in using what amounts to a procedural sideshow to stall the criminal investigation. Cannon's order for a special master is a train wreck of judicial reasoning, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. The Trump appointee argued that the rules don't apply to the former president because, yes, she really said this, he faces higher reputational harm than ordinary people would if any of their personal effects were taken. Her ruling plays with legal concepts, such as executive privilege, which she seems to barely understand. Yet it's not that complicated, said Quinta Juerick in Lawfare. Executive privilege is meant to protect internal executive branch conversations from being disclosed outside the branch. But the Department of Justice is part of the executive branch. Right now, the only person empowered to invoke executive privilege is the incumbent president, namely one Joseph R. Biden, not a former chief executive with a basement full of stolen documents. Let's just let Trump have his special master, said Chris Truax in The Bulwark. Judge Cannon was explicit that nothing should delay an intelligence assessment of any damage done by Trump's possession of the classified documents. And if he does get prosecuted, her show of excessive fairness will make a conviction that much harder to overturn on appeal. Less flimsy than the privilege argument is Trump's claim that he had already declassified the documents, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review. Presidents have broad authority to do so. It's notable, though, that Trump's lawyers have not made that assertion in court. That might be because they know it isn't true. Or they may have figured out that if he actually did declassify highly sensitive national defense secrets en masse without alerting the relevant intelligence and national security agencies, that itself would be a scandal. In some ways, worse than the scandal we now have. In fact, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post, Trump's legal brain trust has yet to offer any substantive defense at all of his conduct, probably because he has no defense. One of the lawyers has already denied knowing that any documents were stored in the Mar-a-Lago office. With his legal team unwilling to take the fall, for him, Trump's problems are only multiplying. It was a good week for higher consciousness when San Francisco's Board of Supervisors voted unanimously to decriminalize magic mushrooms, peyote, ayahuasca, and other plant-based psychedelic drugs. Supervisor Dean Preston said the board was simply following science and data. It was a good week for do-overs with the release of iOS 16, a software update that will give Apple iPhone users up to 15 minutes to edit typos from sent text messages. Users prone to attacks of late-night nostalgia can even delete sent messages entirely, though the window to undo send is cruelly short, 2 minutes. And it was a good week for lunch, with a new study suggesting that eating only during daylight hours can substantially decrease symptoms of depression and anxiety. But it was a bad week for inclusivity when Progressive Representative Pramila Jayapal, the Democrat from Washington, marked the anniversary of 9/11 with a tweet remembering the 2,996 people killed, a number that includes the hijackers. It was a bad week for green energy when a team of West Virginia coal miners came to the rescue of an out-of-state couple whose electric car ran out of battery charge. Miner Daniel House says he steered clear of potentially contentious topics while helping push the couple's car, but did gift them a Friends of Coal license plate souvenir. Finally, it was a bad week for horse trading, with claims that in a new book by New York Times reporter David Enrich that Donald Trump once tried to pay a $2 million legal bill by giving his lawyer a horse. "This isn't the 1800s, the lawyer stammered. "You can't pay me with a horse." In other news, stock trading conflicts rampant in Congress. From 2019 to 2021, 97 sitting senators and House members reported more than 3,700 trades by themselves or their family members in financial assets related to their committee assignments, the New York Times reported this week. As Congress debates tightening rules for lawmaker investing, the Times highlighted numerous ethically doubtful moves. Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, traded contracts tied to cattle prices while his committee discussed cattle markets. Representative Bob Gibbs, Republican from Ohio, bought shares of a pharma firm while his company investigated its high drug prices. And the wife of Representative Alan Lowenthal, Democrat, California, sold Boeing shares a day before his committee released damaging findings about the company's two fatal crashes. Briefing this week is titled, "The New Normal of Weather Whiplash." Large regions in the U.S. and abroad are getting doubly hammered as devastating floods follow historic droughts. What is weather whiplash? It's the paradoxical phenomenon that occurs when areas experiencing wilting drought are also hit with torrential flooding. And it's on the rise. The U.S. is baked under record heat waves and crippling drought this summer, with roughly half the country experiencing at least moderate drought, and huge swaths of the West, Midwest, and Texas under severe drought conditions. But the summer also brought 5,000-year floods, defined as deluges so extreme they have only a 0.1% chance of happening in any given year. Four of those were in areas experiencing drought. The flash flooding that hit Dallas last month, for instance, is a case study in weather whiplash. With dozens of days that sizzled over 100 degrees and 67 straight days with no rainfall, Dallas County, like 27% of Texas, was suffering exceptional drought, the U.S. Drought Monitor's most acute category. Then came a biblical storm that pounded parts of the city with more than a foot of rain in a 12-hour stretch. Neighborhoods and roadways were swamped. Police cars were swept away. Hundreds of people had to be rescued. The whole thing cost up to $6 billion in damages and lost economic output. Where else did this phenomenon strike? St. Louis broke its record for single-day rainfall in late July with a 9-inch downpour that trapped people in their homes and stranded drivers on washed-out streets. The next day, Kentucky was hit with torrential rains that ultimately killed more than 36 people and displaced thousands. Those disasters caused over $1 billion in damage, a catastrophe that could take years to recover from. In Arizona, Nevada, and New Mexico, in the midst of the worst mega drought in 1,200 years, late August monsoon rains brought flash floods that closed highways, cut off power, and submerged the Las Vegas Strip. Even Death Valley, California, the driest spot in America, saw nearly a year's worth of rainfall in several hours in August, stranding hundreds, blowing out a water main, and damaging hundreds of miles of road. Such rapid weather swings are now more violent and disruptive, said Jennifer Francis, a scientist at the Woodwell Climate Research Center in Massachusetts. It's yet another clear signal that the climate crisis is with us now. If the planet continues warming, the swings will become more common. Why is it happening? The same culprit lies behind both the droughts and the deluges: rising global temperatures. As the air warms, it can hold more water vapor, about 4% more for every degree Fahrenheit. Warmer air takes longer to get saturated and then has more water to unleash when it does. An analysis of 150 locations by the group Climate Central found that 90% get harder rainfalls now than in 1970. And by sucking more humidity out of the ground, warmer air not only worsens drought, but also sets the stage for worse flooding. That's because hard, dry ground is less able to absorb water, which leads to excessive runoff. Drought and associated wildfires also kill trees and plants, further reducing the soil's ability to hold water. Because the rain doesn't sink in, it doesn't relieve the underlying drought, and the vicious cycle continues. How is the rest of the world affected? China's southwestern Sichuan province saw an unprecedented heat wave that dried up rivers and reservoirs, shut down hydroelectric plants, and led to the rationing of drinking water. The whiplash came in August when massive flooding forced some 120,000 people to evacuate. Western Europe, too, has been afflicted by both a historic drought, which dried up rivers and exposed sunken World War II ships, and torrential rains, which caused deadly floods across England, France, Germany, and Belgium. And all those disasters have been dwarfed by the catastrophe in Pakistan, where an epic heat wave of temperature above 120 degrees was followed by a monsoon rain that displaced millions, killed at least 1,300, wiped out crops, and submerged more than a third of the country. Wild swings between extreme precipitation and extreme aridity, this is how most people in most ecosystems on Earth are experiencing climate change, said UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain. Can this cycle be stopped? No. Even if humans succeed in slashing carbon emissions, climate scientists agree the near-term changes are baked in. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's 2022 report said with high confidence that the duo of drought and extreme precipitation events will intensify in coming years. To cope, countries must invest in early warning systems, upgrade infrastructure to withstand water, and build new developments with floods in mind. The infrastructure we have is really built for a climate we are not living in anymore, Andreas Prine of the National Center for Atmospheric Research told The Washington Post. These kinds of events are our new normal. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with John Roberts clearly saw this coming. Chief Justice John Roberts knows his conservative colleagues have gone on an activist tear, even if he won't say so publicly, said Ruth Marcus. The court's approval rating has tanked. Just 1 in 4 Americans has confidence in the court, per Gallup, and Roberts is blaming the public for misunderstanding the role of judges. Disagreeing with an opinion, he said last week, is not a basis for criticizing the legitimacy of the court. That convenient framing misrepresents why so many people are fed up with the court's facade of political neutrality. Americans understand that right-wing activists stack the court to guarantee outcomes like the Dobbs abortion decision. The new conservative supermajority abandoned normal rules of restraint, twisted or ignored doctrine, and substituted raw power to achieve its desired result. Ironically, Roberts understands the fallout better than anyone. In 2006, he noted how important it is that the court not appear to be lurching around because of changes in personnel. In his concurring opinion in Dobbs, he warned that stripping abortion rights would cause a serious jolt to the legal system. Now Roberts finds himself in the awkward position of defending against the very criticism he knew was coming. Lord of the Rings versus the Racists. The uproar over multiracial casting in Middle Earth is more than simply the complaints of nerdy purists, said Helen Young. The Rings of Power, an Amazon series that premiered earlier this month, has drawn fire, including an online trolling campaign and negative review bombing of the Amazon Prime site for using actors of color in prominent roles as elves, dwarves, and other denizens of a fantasy world based on J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. These criticisms don't originate with ordinary Tolkien fans, many of whom welcome the increased diversity. They're mostly from far-right political actors who are weaponizing the issue to help get fascist talking points into the mainstream. White supremacists have long claimed Tolkien's work, pointing out that his good races, like elves, are portrayed as Nordic, while the evil ones, like the flat-nosed, slant-eyed orcs, draw on Orientalist stereotypes. These racial hierarchies do make his novels a useful political tool for the far right, but the rich world he built is for everyone, and it simply can't be ceded to those who would use it to divide. The racists have missed another central theme in Tolkien's work, that evil is only defeated when differing peoples form alliances and fight against it together. This column comes from Canada. Horrifying killing spree in Cree Nation. How could those attacks have happened? Asked David Butt. All of Canada is asking the same question after two men stabbed 10 people to death and wounded 18 others in and near the James Smith Cree Nation Reserve in Saskatchewan over Labor Day weekend. There can be no trial, as both suspects are dead. Damian Sanderson was found stabbed to death last week, and his brother Miles died in unclear circumstances days later after police ran him off the road. We can, though, have a public inquiry to determine why Miles, a Cree man with a history of violence, including against his in-laws, who were among the victims, had not been under better supervision. Miles had a shocking 59 convictions, yet was released in February after serving part of a 5-year sentence for assault and robbery, and was not rearrested even after he failed to meet his parole conditions. Canadians need to know whether the social imperative to reduce the shameful overpopulation of Indigenous people in Canadian prisons played a role in his release, as well as how Canada's racist policies may have helped drive him to a life of crime. Preventing future tragedies will require an honest look at what more than a century of racist dehumanization can create over the years. Last word, our feature article, titled this week, The Novel Writing Machine. Writers are turning to artificial intelligence to help them churn out chapters of their books, said Josh Ziza in The Verge. It's making them question what fiction writing is really about. On a Tuesday in mid-March, Jennifer Lepp was precisely 80.41% finished writing Bring Your Beach Owl, the latest installment in her series about a detective witch in Central Florida, and she was behind schedule. The color-coded 11-column spreadsheet she keeps open on a second monitor, as she writes, told her just how far behind. She had 3 days to write 9,278 words. If she was to get the book edited, formatted, promoted, uploaded to Amazon's Kindle platform, and in the hands of eager readers who expected a new novel every 9 weeks. Lett became an author 6 years ago after deciding she could no longer stomach having to spout corporate doublespeak to employees as companies downsized. She had spent the prior 2 decades working in management at a series of web hosting companies, where she developed disciplined project management skills that have translated surprisingly well to writing fiction for Amazon's Kindle platform. In Amazon's self-service publishing arm, Kindle Direct Publishing, Lett found an unexpected avenue into a literary career she had once dreamed of and abandoned. "It's not Dostoevsky," Lett said of her work, but she takes pride in delivering enjoyable potato chip books to her readers, and they reward her with an annual income that can reach the low six figures. Lepp, who writes under the pen name Leanne Leeds, is the paranormal cozy mystery in the paranormal cozy mystery subgenre, allots herself precisely 49 days to write and self-edit a book. "This pace," she said, "is just on the cusp of being unsustainably slow." She once surveyed her mailing list to ask how long readers would wait between books before abandoning her for another writer. The average was 4 months. Writer's block is a luxury she can't afford, which is why as soon as she heard about an artificial intelligence tool designed to break through it, she started beseeching its developers on Twitter for access to the beta test. The tool was called PseudoWrite, designed by developers turned sci-fi authors Amit Gupta and James Yu. It's one of many AI writing programs built on OpenAI's language model, GPT-3, that have launched since it was open to developers last year. But where most of these tools are meant to write company emails and marketing copy, PseudoWrite is designed for fiction writers. Authors paste what they've written into a soothing sunset-colored interface, select some words, and have the AI rewrite them in an ominous tone, or with more inner conflict, or propose a plot twist, or generate descriptions in every sense plus metaphor. Eager to see what it could do, Lepp selected a 500-word chunk of her novel, a climatic confrontation in a swamp between the detective witch and a band of pixies, and pasted it into the program. Highlighting one of the pixies named Nutmeg, she clicked Describe. Nutmeg's hair is red, but her bright green eyes show that she has more in common with creatures of the night than with day, the program returned. Lepp was impressed. "Holy crap," she tweeted. Not only had PseudoWrite picked up that the scene Lepp had pasted took place at night, but also it had gleaned that Nutmeg was a pixie and that Lepp's pixies have brightly colored hair. She wasn't sure how she felt about using AI, but she was always quick to adopt technologies that could help streamline her operation. She had already compiled a database of novels to search when she felt she was overusing a phrase and wanted to see how other authors finished the sentence. She told herself she would use PseudoWrite the same way, just inspiration, no cutting and pasting its prose. Language models like GPT-3 are word prediction machines. Fed an enormous amount of text, the model adjusts its billions of initially randomized mathematical parameters until, when presented with a new text, it does a pretty good job of predicting what words come next. The method gets it surprisingly far. By training on far more text and using far more parameters than past models, GPT-3 gained at least the partial ability to do basic arithmetic, translate languages, write working code, despite never having been explicitly trained in math, translation, or programming, and write plausibly human-seeming prose. But ultimately, GPT-3's entire world is words, or to be precise, mathematical representations of common sequences of characters called tokens. And that can cause it to behave strangely. It might happen to give sensible responses when asked about something people have written abundantly and correctly about. But asked which is heavier, a goldfish or a whale, and it will tell you a goldfish. Or ask why Napoleon said about hamburgers, and it will say, hamburgers are the food of gods. It's just making a guess based on statistical patterns in language, and that may or may not have any correlation to the world as humans understand it. Like a good bullshitter, it's better at form and style than substance. To create Pseudo-Write, Gupta and Yu collected plot twists from short stories and synopses of novels. Presenting them to GPT-3 as examples for descriptions, they wrote sentences about smells, sounds, and other senses so that GPT-3 would know what's being asked of it when a writer clicks describe. And it does generally seem to understand the assignment, though it sometimes takes it in unexpected directions. For instance, Lepp found that the program had a tendency to bestow her characters with swords, despite there not really being any swords in her version of Magical Florida. It would have characters unsheathing blades mid-conversation or fondling hilts as they sat on the porch. She figures this is because the model was likely trained on far more examples of high fantasy than the much smaller genre of paranormal cozy mystery. So when it sees her writing about magic, it assumes some sword unsheathing and hilt fondling is going to happen. There were weirder misfires, too, like when the model kept saying the Greek god Apollo's eyes were as big as a gopher's, or that the moon was truly mother of pearl, the white of sea, rubbed smooth by the groins of drowned brides. Or when it exuberantly overextended metaphors. Alice closed her eyes and sighed, savoring the moment before reality came back crashing down on them like the weight of an elephant sitting on them both while being eaten by a shark in an airplane full of ninjas puking out their eyes and blood for no apparent reason other than that they were ninjas who liked to puke so much they couldn't help themselves from spewing it out of their orifices at every opportunity. Gradually, Lepp figured out how to steer the AI. She would sketch an outline of a scene, press expand, and let the program do the writing. She would then edit the output, paste it back into Pseudo-Write, and prompt the AI to continue. If it started to veer in a direction she didn't like, she nudged it back by writing a few sentences and setting it loose again. She found that she no longer needed to work in complete silence and solitude. Even better, she was actually ahead of schedule. Her production had increased 23.1%. When she finished the first chapter, she sent it back to her beta readers, a group that offers early feedback, with special instructions to highlight anything that sounded off or out of character. Nothing seemed amiss. That was kind of creepy, she said. It starts to make you wonder, do I even have any talent if a computer can just mimic me? Worse, some of the sentences her readers highlighted as being particularly good had come from the machine. But the most disconcerting moment came when she gave the chapter to her husband to read. He turned to her and said, "Wow, you put your favorite sushi restaurant in here," Lepp recalled. She hadn't. It was a scene that was written by the AI. There are probably a lot of sushi restaurants that could be described as having well-lit booths and wood paneling, but soon she noticed other changes. Writing for her had always been a fully immersive process. She would dream about her characters and wake up thinking about them. As the AI took on more of the work, she realized that had stopped. I started going to sleep and I wasn't thinking about the story anymore. And then I went back to write and sat down, and I would forget why people were doing things. Or I'd have to look up what somebody said because I lost the thread of truth. Normally, she wove a subtle moral lesson through her novels, It was something her readers liked. But by chapter 3, she realized she had no idea what this book would be, and she found a moral theme wasn't something she could go back and retroactively insert. Rather than guiding the AI, she started to think she had followed the AI down the rabbit hole. It didn't feel like mine anymore. It was very uncomfortable to look back over what I wrote and not really feel connected to the words or the ideas. Lep adjusted her approach after her alienating experience following the program's lead. She still uses PseudoWrite, but she keeps it on a shorter leash. She pastes everything she's written so far into the program, leaves a sentence half-finished, and only then lets it write. Or she gives it the basics of a scene and tells it to write a description of something specific. Like, I know we're going into the lobby, and I know that this lobby is a secret paranormal fish hospital for naiads, but I don't particularly care what that looks like other than that there's two big fish tanks with tons of fish, and it's high-end, she explained. So she tells it that and gives her 150 words about crystal chandeliers, gold etching, and marble. My time is better spent on the important aspects of the mystery and the story than sitting there for 10 minutes trying to come up with descriptions of the lobby. She's a little embarrassed to say she's become reliant on it. Not that she couldn't write without it, but she thinks her writing wouldn't be as rich, and she would certainly be more burnt out. There's something different about working with the AI and editing those words and then coming up with my own and then editing it. That's much easier. It's less emotionally taxing. It's less tiresome. It's less fatiguing. I need to pay attention much less closely. I don't get as deeply into the writing as I did before, and yet I found a balance where I still feel very connected to the story, and I still feel it's wholly mine. With the help of the program, Lep recently ramped up production yet again. She is now writing two series simultaneously, toggling between the witch detective and a new mystery-solving heroine, a 50-year-old divorced owner of an animal rescue who comes into possession of a magical platter that allows her to communicate with cats. It was an expansion she felt she had to make just to stay in place. With an increasing share of her profits going back to Amazon in the form of advertising, she needed to stand out amid increasing competition. Instead of 6 books a year, her revised spreadsheet forecasts 10. For Lep and her peers, ebooks created an unexpected chance to vault mid-career into a dream job. Reader expectations and Amazon's algorithms have demanded ever faster output, and they've worked hard to keep up. AI may offer a lifeline now, but what happens when the programs get better? How much more acceleration can authors take? There's a concern that we just got our foot in the door. We just got the ability to do this, she said. I think everybody's afraid because we cannot sustain a pace against a computer. The technology isn't there yet. She thinks more fully automating fiction right now would produce novels that are too generic, channeled into the grooves of the most popular plots. But based on the improvement she's seen over the years she's been using PseudoWrite, she doesn't doubt that it will get there eventually. It wouldn't even have to go far. Readers, especially readers of genre fiction, like the familiar, she said. The same basic form with a slightly different twist or setting. It's precisely the sort of thing AI should be able to handle. I think that's the real danger, that you can do that and then nothing's original anymore. Everything's just a copy of something else, she said. The problem is, that's what readers like. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in The Verge. Perhaps not surprisingly, the obituary for Queen Elizabeth is a full page. I'm going to see if we can actually get it in what we have left in the show. The queen who held A Changing Nation Together, Queen Elizabeth II, 1926 to 2022. Queen Elizabeth II was Britain's most steadfast public servant. During her 7 decades on the throne, the longest reigning British monarch in history, was a bulwark of constancy through a time of extraordinary changes, including the reluctant relinquishing of African former colonies, the joining of the European Union, and the leaving of it in Brexit. Her government spanned 15 prime ministers, from the elder statesman Winston Churchill to the newly elected Liz Truss, whom she welcomed just days before her death. Frugal, hardworking, and deeply religious, the Queen studied her box full of government documents with careful diligence every day and went to church faithfully on Sundays. She gave no interviews, and her private thoughts remained as unknown as the contents of her ever-present handbag. She was open only about her dedication to her duties as Queen of the United Kingdom, Supreme Governor of the Church of England, and leader of the British Commonwealth. "I declare before you all," she said in an address from Cape Town, South Africa, on her 21st birthday, "that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and to the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong." Elizabeth Alexandra Mary was the daughter of Albert, Duke of York, the second son of King George V, and his wife Elizabeth of the Scottish aristocracy. As a toddler, she was known as Lilibet, in imitation of her attempts to say her name, said the Times, and that remained her family's pet name for her. Raised by Nanny, she was often left with her doting royal grandparents, and her grandfather, the king, gifted her with her first pony, a Shetland named Peggy, on her 4th birthday. For the rest of her life, she had a love of riding and racing, rivaled only by her fondness for her evolving pack of corgis. "She was not expected ever to rule," said the Guardian, "but after the king died in 1936, her uncle lasted only months as King Edward VIII before abdicating to marry the American divorcee Wallace Simpson. At age 10, Elizabeth was told she was a future queen, and her education took a sudden turn. Constitutional history with the vice provost of Eton College, as well as French lessons and riding and dancing classes. Already a more serious child than her bubbly younger sister Margaret, Elizabeth became aware even then that she should not show emotion and must maintain a certain reserve. Still, she fell in love early and hard at age 13 with the dashing 18-year-old Prince Philip, a Navy cadet and the impoverished nephew of the deposed King of Greece. The two exchanged letters for years and were separated by World War II. Philip saw action while Elizabeth did a brief stint as an auto mechanic before marrying in 1947 in a ceremony that cheered up a war-weary nation. She became pregnant with Charles, the first of her 4 children, just 3 months later, and with her only daughter, Anne, 2 years after that. Elizabeth was on a royal tour in Kenya in 1952 when the news came that her father had died, making her queen at age 25, said the Washington Post. The empire she was touring soon ceased to exist. India had become independent a few years earlier, and Ghana, Kenya, and many other British territories fought for independence in the early years of her reign. But as monarch of the Commonwealth of 15 realms and more than 50 nations, Elizabeth kept Britain closely linked to its former territories, sometimes irritating prime ministers such as Margaret Thatcher, who didn't value the connections as she did. When Australians voted in 1999 not to break away as a republic, the vote was seen as reflecting a loyalty to Elizabeth rather than the UK. Her family members were rather less popular and more prone to scandal, said the New York Times. Early in her reign, her sister Margaret sought permission to marry a divorced man, something Elizabeth, as head of the Church of England, had to decline. 40 years later, in 1992, 3 of her children's marriages fell apart. Charles separated from his vastly more popular wife, Diana. Anne divorced her husband, Mark Phillips, and Andrew separated from his wife, Sarah Ferguson. Windsor Castle also burned that year, and the Queen was forced for the first time to agree to pay income taxes. In a major speech in November of that year, Elizabeth proclaimed 1992 her Annus Horribilis. Yet the drama wouldn't peak until 5 years later when Diana was killed in a Paris car crash and the British people erupted in a massive outpouring of public grief. The Queen's dispassionate response and initial refusal to lower the Union Jack to half-mast at Buckingham Palace left her seeming cold and emotionally estranged from her subjects, an uncharacteristic misstep. It was one of several times in her reign that public opinion began flirting with the abolition of the monarchy. The royal family stayed in the tabloid, said the Telegraph, UK. Elizabeth's grandson, Prince Harry's bride, Meghan Markle, a divorced biracial American actress, was unhappy as Duchess, and after the couple decamped for the U.S., they gave an interview hinting at racism in the royal family. Meanwhile, Prince Andrew, the Queen's favorite child, was forced to give up royal duties after being accused of sexual assault on a teenage girl at the Manhattan townhouse of his longtime friend, the pedophile financier Jeffrey Epstein. But despite all the turmoil, Elizabeth found ways to show her keen sense of fun in later years. At the opening of the London Olympics in 2012, the Queen, then 86, was shown seemingly parachuting out of a helicopter with actor Daniel Craig as James Bond. And for her Platinum Jubilee celebration earlier this year, she appeared in a video with the CGI Paddington Bear, pulling a marmalade sandwich from her purse. After Prince Philip died in 2021, though, the Queen's health declined noticeably. She cut a frail figure at his funeral, where she had to sit alone in a pew because of COVID restrictions, and she began holding more audiences at her Scottish home, Balmoral Castle, rather than traveling to the palace in London. Still, she continued working until the end, a duty she saw as owed to God. When life seems hard, she said in 2008, the courageous do not lie down and accept defeat. Instead, they are all the more determined to struggle for a better future. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.